It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 80 for Friday, the 14th of June, 2012. This week, we're going to learn how one band decided to sample the sound of a binary star system for its forthcoming album, what the result is of a bloke who's played the same game of Civilization 2 for a decade, and we're going to find out why a document describing the perverted sex lives of penguins was all but buried for 100 years, until now. All that and more coming up. Ahoy hoy, Nate Langson here, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, of course, in the trinket cupboard, Duncan of Gear.
Hello.
Our news editor.
How are you?
I'm well. We're sadly missing Liv this week because she's sick. Get well soon, Liv.
Get well soon, Liv.
Yeah, but we have a new lady voice in the house. Say hi, lady voice.
Hi.
That's Liat, and she is going to be joining us in a bit to talk about penguins. Let's start off with the news. Duncan, there is a comms bill that has come out
this
week.
Yes, this is kind of an interesting one, and it's potentially a little bit concerning. The government has published a draft version of the Communications Data Bill, and we've discussed this a little bit before on the podcast, so regular listeners will know a little bit about it. But this bill, if accepted into law, would force ISPs and phone companies in Britain to keep records of every phone call, email, and website visit that takes place.
This doesn't mean that they can snoop and read my email to you before the show.
Not quite, no. So the way it works is that authorities will no longer need a warrant to see who conversations are between and when and where they're made, but they will need a warrant to actually see the contents of those emails and phone calls and text messages and so on.
Ah, they can see the content if they ask.
That will be doled out on a how important it is basis, but yeah. there's a lot of information you can get about somebody and what they're doing just based on who they're talking to and when they're talking to them and where they're talking to them from. You know, there's an awful amount of kind of privacy implications of that.
Well, this is all about busting terrorists, right, isn't it?
Well, yes, supposedly, but the fear is that it will be used much, much more widely by a range of different groups, and keeping control over who gets to access that data is going to be very, very important, and that will be a subject of big debate over the next year.
Speaking of debates, though, there was some sort of backlash against this, wasn't there?
Yes, that's right.
From Open Rights Group, I know.
Jim Killick of the Open Rights Group said that the government's notes confirm that this is exactly what we expected. Black boxes to intercept people's traffic data and poorly supervised police powers to get access to it. Bluntly, these are as dangerous as we expected and represent unprecedented surveillance powers in the democratic world.
Yeah, hang about. This is a point. Do you think this is a little bit like being able to open somebody's post? Like if you sort of intercept the Royal Mail? Is it kind of like that in the same way?
There is an aspect of it to that. I mean, it's kind of more about logging exactly who sends a mail.
Yeah.
a letter, I guess, or a package or a parcel or something. Logging automatically every time that anybody sends one of those packages or parcels to another person, where they were when they sent it.
Right.
You know, and who they sent it to. But the difference is that instead of sending, you know, a letter every, I don't know, month, how often do you send letters these days?
I haven't sent one this year.
Yeah, exactly. You're sending, but how, by contrast that with how many emails you've sent today, text messages, website visits, you know, it's hundreds just for a single person in a morning.
It would definitely be more beneficial to spy on my email, I guess, than spy on my post.
Yes.
But it's comparable then to being able to spy who was in which post office buying which stamp for which letter, rather than being able to open the mail itself.
Yes.
That's what we're talking about here, a digital version of that.
Correct. But the point is that you can get an awful lot of data about people just from that information.
Yeah.
You don't need to necessarily know what the message says. It can still be cause for suspicion, even if you're not necessarily doing anything wrong. It just happens to look weird. Theresa May, the Home Secretary, defended it by saying that as criminals make increasing use of internet-based communications, I love the idea that criminals are making increasing use of the internet.
As
if not everybody else is as well. But she said, we need to ensure that the police and the intelligence agencies continue to have the tools they need to do the job we ask of them, investigating crime and terrorism, protecting the vulnerable, and bringing criminals to justice.
I'll tell you something. I'm going to throw a spanner in the works here. I don't think this is all that bad, to be perfectly honest.
So you'd be fine if, I don't know, I knew when you sent a text message.
Yeah, I would be bothered if you personally knew who I sent a text message to.
What if I worked for a government agency that had access to that data?
Well, yeah, I mean, I could argue that. But what I'm saying is that there are protections that are needed to find out who people are. And these sorts of measures are and have been proven in the past to be useful. Right, there are certain arguments that are like, who has access to the data? Who's in charge of making sure that the people who have access to that data aren't doing nefarious things with it? I agree that I'm not saying that this is absolutely fine. What I'm saying is that I think that these technical measures as long as policed correctly and the right procedures are being followed aren't necessarily a bad thing. I think if we're talking about blanket ability to read people's emails and stuff like that, I would say, well, that is getting into very different territory.
I would completely disagree. I think there's far too much information that you can get off somebody just from who they're contacting and when, not even including the content of their messages, that making that data more widely available is a really, really bad thing.
And why so paranoid, Duncan? No one gives a damn about what my emails... All my emails today have pretty much been to you or someone on the team, or I've texted my girlfriend, I've texted my brother.
The other side of this, of course, is that it's going to be incredibly easy for criminals to hide these things. You know, all you need to do is encrypt your connection, use a proxy server, something like that.
Yeah.
And the government and the police won't be able to track you. So it's going to be ineffective at doing what it's set out to do, and it will catch a whole lot of people in the crossfire. That's why I don't like this bill, personally speaking.
Well, we've manufactured a for and against. If you are for or if you are against, follow up. Are you on... Well, I don't really agree with everything I just said. I just want to argue. But whether you have an opinion or not, no, if you have an opinion, send us an email, podcast@wired.co.uk. Binary stars, Duncan. These have been in the news this week because data gathered from two binary stars using the Kepler Space Telescope has been transformed into a reggae riff for an American reggae rock band.
Reggae?
Yeah. Do you want to hear it?
I would. Yeah, okay.
Let's play the sound that the next story is the subject of, sort of. So that is the sound of two binary stars orbiting each other, or at least one star in a binary system orbiting the other one. And this was captured for the group Echo Movement. They've got some great songs, by the way, I've noticed in our story, in the beginning, Across the Universe, and I Think God Smokes Weed. I reckon this is because they're interested in space. What do you think, Duncan?
I think it's probably because they're interested in reggae.
Okay. Anyway, this group approached the Georgia Tech Sonification Lab with a request to make audio samples of stars captured by the Kepler Space Telescope. And they looked at the dimming and brightening of the stars as they passed in front of each other, and then took that numerical info and processed it to be audible, which is a technique actually that astrophysicists use to recognize patterns. It's a bit easier than staring at a giant page of numbers, I guess. And then those sounds were sort of cleaned up a bit and were turned into that sample you heard earlier, and that is going to appear in a forthcoming album. I think it's a really interesting way to sample data.
Well, I look forward to hearing it. When's it going to be out?
The album, well, it's going to be on a song that I think that's out in September, which is pretty good. Let's move on. Duncan, Civilization, a game. Yeah. Civilization 2 specifically.
Yeah, do you remember playing Civilization 2?
I played Civilization 1. Amiga, Atari?
Certainly some of our listeners will have played Civilization 2. I know that I played it to death way back in the 90s. And a Reddit user named Lycerius, which is a good username, has been playing this same game of Civilization 2 for a decade. He wanted to find out exactly what the in-game world would look like by the year 3991.
So he carried on playing it for ages.
I mean, there is when you're normally playing a game of Civilization 2, it will end by, I don't know, somebody conquering the entire world, or somebody building the UN and everyone voting for peace forever after, or something like that. Or somebody, I think you can send a space rocket up into space, and that's a science victory. But he continued after that point. You've got the option to carry on. He just carried on. And by the year 3991, it turned out that only three supernations remained. There were two theocratic nations, the Vikings and the Americans, and the communist Celts, each of them competing, as he put it, for the scant resources left on the planet after dozens of nuclear wars have rendered vast swathes of the world uninhabitable wastelands.
I think this is a pretty impressive test of civilization's algorithmic powers.
It certainly is.
Because the fact that you could carry on for 10 years and get to this sort of a conclusion almost certainly wasn't in the original design spec for the game.
Yeah, he's stuck in this really interesting stalemate where nuclear fallout from these vast nuclear wars have caused the ice caps to melt, and every inch of land on the planet is turned into swamp, which doesn't provide much in the way of resources. So 90% of the world's population has been killed because there's no land to farm, and the remaining engineers just constantly are building roads that are destroyed by more nuclear missiles the very next turn.
So what's all this about a war, being locked in a war forever?
Yeah, as I said, the stalemate has been going on for about 2,000 years of war. There have been various UN peace treaties and ceasefires in the same time, but almost immediately they're cancelled and spies will sneak sneak nuclear weapons into cities and blow them up. And this game is just stuck. And he says, I can only assume that peace will come only when the other civilizations are wiped out. Which sounds like propaganda to me.
So he's going to upload his save game so people can play it?
Yeah, well, there's been this vast amount of interest in this game that he's created. And people saying, I think I might be able to win that. And so what he's done is he's uploaded his save game to a particular subreddit. I think it's called The Eternal War, so that other Reddit players and people from the rest of the web can step into his shoes and try and sort it out. And yeah, in this subreddit, there's already people discussing potential strategies for how they might achieve victory in this stalemate, and fan fiction and all kinds of things. It's fascinating to see.
It's awesome. It's really awesome. It'd be great to see in like 3 years' time how each different game played by different people has evolved.
Yeah,
and like if they've evolved in different ways, or if they're all essentially going towards the same goal. Well, to upload a save game, you would need the internet, and we have a bit of bad news for the UK's internet users. Well, if you like the Pirate Bay, that is. The UK's ISPs, major ISPs, now all, except for one, block access to the Pirate Bay. So that's Virgin Media, TalkTalk, Everything Everywhere, that's Orange, O2B and Sky now all banish you from the realms of the Swedish file sharing site.
But you said all but one.
Yes, BT is the outstanding one here, so you can still access the Pirate Bay through BT because they asked for more time to implement technical measures. I'm quite surprised, to be perfectly honest, because all the others have managed it very fast. TalkTalk was the most recent to ban it. And it's all because the High Court ruled that the Swedish site and its users were committing copyright infringement. This is the result of a case brought to the court by the music industry, Sony, EMI and Universal specifically. So, but we've discussed in the past that these sorts of blocks are incredibly pointless, and the UK's Pirate Party set up, I think, a separate site where you can still access.
Yeah, they've set up a proxy so that anybody on any of these services can just go to an entirely different website and they'll get the Pirate Bay, exactly like they would have done otherwise. A similar thing happened in, I think, the Netherlands, a European country, when it was blocked there by the major ISPs, and almost immediately the local Pirate Party set up a proxy. And of course, the next thing that will probably happen is that Sony, EMI, Universal will take up law, legal action against the Pirate Party to try and get that mirror taken down. But that will take ages to actually happen, and then once it does, someone else will just set up another. It's whack-a-mole, essentially.
It is, and it always
is. It's the world's slowest game of whack-a-mole.
It is. It's always the case when shutting these sorts of sites down. It's like shutting Mega Upload. You know, people just move to RapidShare or any of these other sorts of file hosting sites. But this only affects major ISPs. This is what's really interesting. I mean, it's obvious that they would target the biggest players because they want to take down the most people. But it does mean that the smaller ISPs now potentially have new customers coming to them, because to show, I don't know, anti-support for this movement, you could leave your ISP, go to a smaller one, and give them some funds and make them a bigger ISP.
I mean, it probably would have happened if this was the case. I'm not entirely sure about how it works, but I guess there's no legal tool for the High Court to just say the entire ISP industry has to block it. It has to be done on a company-by-company basis.
Yeah, but the other way to do it would be to block BitTorrent as a protocol, which actually would stop even the...
Yeah, but that would be impossible. There are far too many legal applications of BitTorrent. Yeah. Like, for example, World of Warcraft and all Blizzard games, in fact, distribute patches through BitTorrent. It's just a communications protocol. You may as well ban telephones.
You might. Duncan, the Chinese have been cloning villagers.
That sounds so much creepier than... Well, actually, no, it is quite creepy.
No, that is exactly the headline. China's cloned village opens.
Yeah, they've... The village of Hallstatt in Austria. Have you ever been to Hallstatt?
No.
No, it's very, very pretty. It's by the...
I've eaten cheese in Austria, though. Does that count?
No, that doesn't count. It's by a beautiful lake called the Hallstatter Sea, and it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's got the Alps in the background. It's a fantastically beautiful place. And the Chinese liked it so much that they have built an exact clone of it in the province of Guangdong.
They copy-pasted.
Essentially, yeah. It's the China Minmetals Corporation, run by a chap called Zhongshu, who... have built this clone, which cost them around £600 million to build. It occupies about 1 million square meters, and it's almost an exact clone of the original, down to the clock tower, down to the gabled roofs and everything. The individual houses are going to go on sale to investors in the project.
I find it a bit weird you can clone an entire village for £600 million. That doesn't seem very much.
It isn't.
There are buildings that cost more than that.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, most of these sort of buildings are Like, I don't know exactly how much they've cloned the internal structure of the buildings, whether it's just the outside that looks the same or whether it's exactly the same materials being built in exactly the same way. I suspect they've used modern construction methods.
Or maybe it'd be like a sort of a one of those villages in North Korea our intern Ian was telling us about. He visited some. They just have kind of a really nice looking face, and then there are basically dumps behind this face. So when tourists pass through, it looks really nice, but it's actually a bit of a crap hole.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, as I say, they're going to be selling the interiors of these things to the investors. So I imagine it's going to be a bit nicer inside than in North Korea. But yeah. What's particularly interesting is how the residents of the real Hallstatt responded to this. Originally, they were a little bit put out, but then they were won over time by the idea of kind of getting this marketing opportunity in one of the world's fastest growing countries for tourism. And basically the hope being that after Chinese people visited the cloned Hallstatt, they might say, oh, well, now I want to see the real thing. And that has actually proven to kind of be true. Apparently thousands, and this is according to Austrian officials, thousands of Chinese tourists now fly to the real village every year, up from fewer than 50 in 2005. So you know, it's worked.
There's a Channel 4 documentary in the making here, Extreme Town Twinning.
It doesn't get any more twinned than that, does it?
I don't think it could be possible to be more twinned. It's identical town twinning at best. Well, I think we've got a picture on the site of this place, haven't we, on the website?
I think the picture on the site is, well, is it of the clone or is it of the original?
Let us know. Podcast it, whatever. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we're going to find out a bit about what Apple's been releasing this week and also the mad sex lives of penguins.
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
Welcome back. Duncan, on a scale of 1 to 10, how excited were you about this week's Apple news?
Higher than I've ever been.
It's true. To the point that you went to the store to try and spend like £2,000 in a morning for the first time on an Apple thing ever.
Yeah, I mean, the only Apple product I've ever bought is my iPad, which I like very much. But yeah, the new MacBooks, which we'll talk about in a second, are really, really tasty. I think they are very, very interesting.
Yeah, we don't want to go overboard but on sort of talking about the news, because I imagine a lot of our listeners do already know about it. But we have been in the sort of advantageous position of being able to use pretty much all of the things that have been announced this week. First, iOS 6, which was announced for the iPhone and iPad. They've got rid of Google Maps, Duncan, and they have gotten bored and in bed with TomTom.
Yeah.
Free turn-by-turn navigation coming to the iPhone.
Yeah, for the first time ever.
Yeah, I think that's going to be out in August or autumn as part of iOS 6. They've improved Siri, the virtual assistant app, so it now knows UK businesses and cinema listings and restaurants and stuff.
Though I tested it and it wasn't working very well when I tried it, so hopefully they'll spruce that up before the actual rollout.
So some good results of the TomTom mapping, though. There was a fairly efficient map around the back of Buckingham Palace, which was quite cool. But iOS 6 looks pretty interesting. Siri on the new iPad as well looks pretty cool. What else we got? New MacBooks, yes. One of them has a Retina display like the iPad. Now, you are most excited about this.
Yeah, well, a Retina display is basically just high resolution. Apple says something like, you can't see the individual pixels, but that's actually nonsense. You can see them.
If you get close enough.
If you get close enough, which, you know, you have been, I've been looking over at your desk most of today, and you've been like a few centimeters away from the screen inspecting various things.
I have
you?
I've been Inspector Gadget.
What have your gadget eyes uncovered?
Well, I've noticed a few things about the new Retina Mac. I mean, firstly, it is a very powerful computer, but that's sort of the least interesting aspect of it. More interesting is the screen. And when you first look at it, you do kind of get blown away. It is the best screen I've ever seen on a laptop. But what is particularly interesting is the fact that all apps need to be updated pretty much to support this massive resolution. It's like 2880 by 1800 pixels. So we're talking significantly more pixels and resolution on a 15-inch laptop screen than is in like a 64-inch plasma telly. Like, it's absolutely huge how much detail's on here. But it means that most applications, if they haven't been redesigned for the Retina display, have to be blown up really, really big. And because the screen's so good, it means that the artifacts that you can see as a result of applications and things being blown up twice their size are more visible than they would be if they were just blown up large as opposed to on a smaller screen.
So right now it actually looks worse than a regular display for most applications.
I would for most applications at the moment it do, they don't look great. They don't look bad, but they when you compare them to what a Retina application looks like on it, they do look a lot worse. But when you do look at sort of something like Aperture looking at photos, when Apple on stage said it's like looking at a printed page, it actually really, really is. Like, you look at it, and it's kind of... It, to be honest, it's more impressive, I think, than the iPhone because, or the iPad because of how big the screen also is. So you look at this big picture, and not only is it big, but it's got this stupid amount of resolution in it. And as a result of that, I think that Apple is really gearing this towards creative professionals, image editors, photographers, video editors, and they really are the people that will, on day one, get the most advantage out of this. And it's kind of like what I said about the iPad 3, is that if you go out on day one and buy it, you'll probably find that there are certain things that are obvious not necessarily the way you would like them. Give it 6 months and developers start updating their apps left, right and center and it'll be a lot better. But certainly
yeah, I think it's fair to say that a lot of these problems will be solved over time.
Absolutely. It just the developers just need to up the resolution of their apps so they don't need to be blown up by the operating system. But very, very impressive.
And how kind of like on a hardware level, it's also considerably thinner than the existing Macs.
Oh yeah, that's the other thing. They got rid of the optical drive, so there's no DVD drive in it anymore. It's almost bar 1 millimeter as thin as the thickest part of the MacBook Air.
Yeah, which so it doesn't feel quite in your hands quite like a MacBook Air does, because obviously the MacBook Air tapers to a point.
Yeah.
But the very thickest part of the MacBook Air over at the hinge,
yeah,
it's kind of that thickness all the way along. Is that how it works?
All the way along, yeah, all the way along. And
kind of how does that compare to other kind of laptops on the market?
It beats them into the ground with a shovel and then laughs at them and then beats them into the ground and runs off with all their money laughing, basically.
Right.
It is very impressive. It's just that some of the apps at the moment look a bit poo.
So give it a few months.
Oh, yeah. If your job is editing photos and videos and stuff, then go and buy one. It looks awesome. But if you're a Duncan, and I advise Duncan with this, I'd say wait, don't rush. Wait a couple of months, wait for some of the more popular apps to get updated, and then
see how it goes.
Go and get one. Yeah. The other weird thing, actually, you know, the 17-inch model, they've killed that. So there is
completely 17-inch MacBook Pro.
No 17-inch MacBook Pro. All gone, because the resolution on the 15-inch is significantly higher than the resolution was on the 17, so there's no need for it.
And I suppose they're also trying to sell their massive, great big Thunderbolt displays, aren't they?
Well, there's that. Oh, my God. Could you imagine a Retina Thunderbolt display? That's a 30-inch screen. It'd be something...
Well, we better move on before your head explodes.
Oh, that'd be a great way to die, though. I'm going to have my review of the new MacBook Pro on the website, probably by the time you listen to this. So if you search MacBook Pro Retina, you will find it. We're going to move on to talking about mad penguin sex. Liat, you are still here. Hello.
Hello.
Now, I asked you to join us for this because you are our new staff writer at Wired, and we thought that it would be great to get you writing about crazy penguins to begin with, which was pretty good. So the news here is that a 100-year-old manuscript that rather graphically describes the bizarre sexual practices of Adelie penguins in Antarctica has been uncovered. It's fittingly called The Sexual Habits of Adelie Penguins and was found in a dusty drawer of a London museum. Who actually made this document, this crazy thing?
George Murray Levick, who was a surgeon with the Royal Navy, who was a member of the Northern Party who set off with Scott in 1910.
As
in Captain Scott.
Yes.
It was a very ordinary guy who just started out in a medical career and somehow ended up as a keen zoologist joining the Terra Nova.
So he went out and found these penguins, and it wasn't what he wrote wasn't actually deemed publishable basically at the time, was
no,
it?
No,
because
not
it was
at all.
It was grim.
It was pretty grim. I mean, I think they did see value in it because they ended up publishing a separate manuscript and sending it to 100 experts, but they refused to publish it in its entirety, mainly because it was pretty shocking stuff for
I don't know if I dare ask this, but if you're listening and you've got sensitive souls around you, then put your hands over their ears. But so what are some of the things that this manuscript said?
You'd like some examples.
Yes.
Well, I mean, penguins having sex with dead penguins is probably one of the key things that stood out for Levick.
Bestio necrophilia sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, he perceived it as necrophilia, but really it was a penguin seeing a female penguin lying back and not really considering The consequences of having sex with a dead penguin.
And he didn't even want to write this in English, did he? He wrote this in Greek.
He did, yeah. He had it. I mean, he wrote it all down in his personal diary and then shamefully started pasting over a Greek translation, which is also going to be in the exhibit that's at the Natural History Museum.
Yeah, let's talk about that a sec, because where this was found at the Natural History Museum, right, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. It was found by a curator there, Douglas Russell, when he was just digging around in the old archives. And he found this perfectly preserved manuscript, unbound manuscript, and investigated further and found out there were 100 copies of this distributed. But
100 copies?
Yeah. Only two survived, though, I think. One with Lord Rothschild.
So despite the fact he was so embarrassed he was translating it into Greek, he still made 100 copies of it spread to his close friends.
The museum decided it was worthwhile and then, buried it away.
And this was in like 1912, wasn't it? So I mean, there's a thing in your piece, I think, from, I'm not sure who the quote is from right now, you'll probably remind me, but it says that, you know, this is a time of the world where Lady Chatterley's lover would be censored. If you can't cope with Lady Chatterley, then how are you going to be able to cope with penguins having sex with dead penguins?
Yes.
50 years ahead of its time, apparently. So it exactly sort of 1962, dead penguins sex was okay.
It was suddenly deemed acceptable. It's because then we understood what they were really doing. These penguins were just a little lost. They were trying to keep the species alive. They didn't understand that they were having sex with dead penguins, but at the time they obviously wanted to protect a very sensitive public. And
I want to ask another bit. What is your favorite bit, because you look through the whole thing? What's the bit that stood out for you?
Well, it has to be
you're going red, I can tell.
It has to be the story of one very persistent penguin who fails on his first time trying to mount a female.
A dead or alive female?
Oh, she's alive. She's injured, actually.
Right.
So she's unable to stand up. Runs off to steal some stones from a nest nearby. So he nicks some stones, piles them up neatly, and has another go.
Wow.
And is successful on his second time. He just tried so hard.
That's amazing.
That's dedication. And so if say I had a friend who was curious about going to see this, where would this friend go and look at it?
This friend would head to the Natural History Museum before September 2nd to, I think it's Scott's Last Expedition is on there, and it's a series of artifacts and specimens they brought back, along with his original diaries.
Which I'm noticing here was emblazoned with the title "Not for Publication."
Yes, well, we've scuppered that one now. Yeah.
Sorry,
I will tell my friend that. Thank you very much.
Well, I know you've got a great story on the site. You interviewed a whole bunch of people for this. I think if you search for penguin sex on Y.co.uk,
yeah, pretty much,
probably find that.
Yeah, I think that will do it.
Awesome stuff, Liat. Thank you. We've got one last story to get to. If you have children, you're welcome to bring them back into the room now. The world's largest telescope, in fact, has been given the green light to get built. That's a terrible sentence, but you know what I mean. It's going to cost £8 billion, and it will be capable of directly imaging large exoplanets.
So hang on, what are exoplanets?
An exoplanet is a planet that is outside of our solar system, orbiting their own stars, their own sun. This telescope has got a fantastic name. It's called the European Extremely Large Telescope. Who gets paid to come up with these names? These guys are geniuses, and they're not paid to be writers, I suppose.
They don't have a marketing department, I guess.
No, but the telescope hopes to be able to gather more light than all existing 8 to 10 metre telescopes currently on Earth combined. That is a huge amount of light that this thing's going to be able to capture. It's the Australia, the Czech Republic, Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden and Switzerland have all said yes to building it. And Belgium, Finland, Italy and us, the UK, have given the thumbs up but need their governments to finalise a vote. So if you're in the government, and I know there are people in the government who listen to our show, please
Thumb it up.
With this.
So hang on. So you said it's going to be imaging exoplanets.
Yeah.
But that's not the only thing that it's going to be able to study, right?
No, it can also study sort of things around stars. Like, it actually pick up water molecules as well. So should be able to pick up vapor and stuff like that, I think, around.
So we can find Earth too.
We sort of have found a candidate. Kepler 1950... I can't remember one now. We have found one candidate for Earth 2 already by Kepler earlier this year. But yes, we can eventually find Earth 3.
And 4.
And five. It should hopefully get going by the early 2020s. And David Southwood, who is the president of the Royal Astronomical Society, has urged himself, the UK government, to approve the RAS's involvement, quote, as soon as possible, so that British scientists and engineers can take a full role in what is set to be one of the most exciting scientific projects of the 21st century.
Can't wait.
I cannot wait. I really cannot wait. It's going to be amazing. Leah, is it amazing?
It's amazing.
It is, isn't it? And on that amazing note, we are going to wrap up the show. Duncan, tell people how they can tell us how amazing that story was.
they can phone us 0208 123 0468, either from a landline or a mobile phone. Leave us a 30-second message, or alternately, you could do exactly the same thing over Skype by calling Wired UK Podcast, all one word.
Yep, and follow us on Twitter. We're at Wired UK. Our Facebook page is always open, arms akimbo, ready for your feedback to be inserted into it. It's facebook.com/WiredUK, and email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
You should definitely do that.
Always. Leah, it has been nothing but a pleasure to have you in the room while we did this.
Thank you very much.
You are very welcome. And we'll catch you all next week.
Bye-bye. How many hours of sleep do you get every night?
My fly keeps coming down.
That's all right.
There's my outro.